Now I have a machine gun.
Ho, ho, ho.
Merry Christmas from These Three Fruitcakes on Cut Print Film, episode 41. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet, and all the little internets. Merry Christmas! It's Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 41. I'm Jeff Rollins.
I'm Dave Costell.
And I'm Christmas Evangelista. Ooh. See what I did there?
I love what you did there.
That's also my legal birth name.
Hey,
I'm Dave Christmastle.
Shut up!
Wow, that didn't work. I wanted to say, if there are any little internets listening to this, you should not be listening without parental guidance. Because we use harsh language like, gosh darn it.
Things get salty on this show.
And motherfucker.
And Father Mucker, too.
We do say Father Mucker.
Do we? I don't think so. Anyway, what are we?
We are a film podcast.
Sounds like an existential question.
Well.
And we hail from cutprintfilm.com, a website where you can find all sorts of movie reviews, editorials, interviews, you know, things like that.
Yeah, really important stuff.
That's right.
Cutting edge, what you could say.
We are on the cutting edge.
Yeah. Is there movie news there?
There is.
Oh, that's right.
Speaking of movie news.
Oh.
Something happened this week.
That's right.
Oh.
Let me find out.
Let me look on Mr. Skin. What are we? You're speaking of the debacle involving Sony Pictures and the film The Interview.
And the country North Korea.
Oh, yes.
And the scoundrels hackers.
Yes, or South Korea, as I keep mistakenly typing I type the news bits up.
South Korea is specifically where you can find music from Psy.
Oh, okay.
And
well, that's a crime on its own.
But yeah, North Korea, home of the greatest haircut on the planet. what happened here exactly?
All right, so The Interview is a film about, it's got James Flacco, Spader, as our president called him, and what's the other guy? Seth Rogen, and they go to North Korea to interview Kim Jong, is it Un now? Kim Jong-un, and eventually they end up killing him in the movie. Spoiler for a movie that you'll maybe never see. And apparently North Korea was not happy about that, so some North Korean hackers hacked into Sony Pictures, and this has been going on for a while now. And basically, they were leaking Sony emails and all this other stuff, and they leaked Sony films onto the internet. And for a while, everyone was just sort of like, whatever, you know, it's just, what's the big deal?
Well,
and then
everyone was unethically reporting on all the emails.
We sort of took the high ground, and we didn't report
any news that came out of these leaked emails, because that's called stealing.
Yeah, it just seemed wrong to, like, report stuff like that as news. But anyway, then it got really serious because basically the hackers sent a message saying, if you release The Interview into theaters, we will launch 9/11 style attacks on theaters, which obviously is just bullshit because they don't have that capability. But as you know, just for liability, people took it seriously and theaters started pulling it. And basically,
Sony gave theaters the option to show or not show the movie.
Right.
And they all took them up on the on the chance to not show
it. At first it was small theater, like bow tie theaters was like, we're pulling it, but then pretty much all the major theaters said we're not gonna play the movie.
Did they send the threat via Psy? Like, 9/11 style.
Again, Dave, that's South Korea.
Oh,
this is North Korea.
After every theater pulled the film, Sony said, we're going to cancel it. And so The Interview is not coming out at the moment, but eventually it'll probably come out somewhere. Who knows where.
And as of yesterday or 2 days ago, they ripped all mention of The Interview from Facebook, Twitter.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah, they took all that promotional stuff down.
But then even weirder was the other day, I think it was on Friday, the hacker sent another message saying... With this, and this blew my mind more than anything.
Also because of the way it was written, like a lunatic with a headache or something.
Basically, the hacker said, "All right, you've guys suffered enough. Go ahead and release The Interview." Like, what's up, wishy-washy hackers? So
I think what that might have been was the Koreans like not realizing this would have worked so well, and they were just like, "Oh man,
because we're
in big trouble."
Because it shouldn't have worked this way. Like the bit, like. Look, I don't care about the film The Interview. I have no actual interest in even seeing this movie. But
the only chance I would have seen it is if I were the one that got assigned to go to the screening and review it.
Right.
And I wasn't, so I would have never seen this film.
The problem with this is it sets a bad precedent, because basically this sends a message saying if you don't like a movie that's coming out, if you bitch long enough, they're just going to give in and pull it. And that's a really bad that's a bad precedent to set as far as movies go.
I don't fault I don't know who to fault though. Like I don't fa- I could see the theater's perspective, I can see Sony's perspective.
Right. I get why everyone did what they did, but still it's just I don't know.
What you fault is our culture. That's what you fault, because everybody complaining about
our
Sony,
culture club.
Yeah, exactly. The Boy Georges and what have you. Everybody complaining about Sony pulling the interview and saying, well, we should all demand that they show it and we'll all be there first thing. Those exact same people would be the first ones to lawyer up if there were an attack at one of these screenings.
Or not even that. They'd be the same people on Twitter the next day after the attack being like, how could Sony release that movie?
Yeah, it's
so
true.
Sony was in a really bad spot.
Yeah, I don't fault Sony at all in this.
Well, I do fault them for making terrible films this year.
Oh, yes, that,
I do fault them for that.
Well, yeah, well. I mean, if I fault anyone, I definitely do fault theaters. Just because, again, even though I get it, because theaters don't want attacks, I also just... I think theater chains are, you know, run by assholes, so I don't want to support them in any sort of way.
Yeah, and it
it's like you said, $17 sodas.
Yeah, it's like enough. Like, honestly,
9/11 style already.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, honestly, the best thing to do would be to release this VOD, but or you know, video on demand for those out there. I don't know what that means, but one thing that is probably holding Sony up for this is that the movie is insured, as all movies are insured, and basically. If Sony never releases it, they could claim insurance money on that, and they could reap a profit.
Oh, yeah, whereas, they're going to write this bad boy off.
Right, whereas if they release it on VOD, they can't claim that money. So, who, I mean...
They're also a Japanese company, which makes things a little trickier, because you can pretty much see North Korea from the shores of Japan, which is a totally different situation than what we're in as Americans, you know?
Right.
Like, if they're going to retaliate, they're most likely going to do it to Japan.
Right. And
if the guy in charge at the top of Sony is Japanese, he is. There's no reason for him to even risk it. You know?
Right. Absolutely. So I mean, I don't love the situation. It's a he.
It's Godzilla, I believe.
I don't love the situation, but I do understand.
I love the situation.
Oh.
Really?
You mean
starring the character from MTV's. Whatever that is, the Jersey Shore.
I don't even know.
The situation. I believe he's talking about his abdominals.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Are we done with that? Tom?
I don't know. The thing that makes it... I wish this were over a better movie. And again, I haven't seen the interview, so maybe it is good. But, like, the interview has gone from being a movie that probably would have come out, made somewhat okay money, and then would have been forgotten.
Yeah.
Now this movie is part of film history. Like, going forward... Like, film classes, they're going to teach about the interview. And that sort of, like, boggles my mind.
It's kind of like one of those cool anomalies in film history. You know what I mean? Because I would be pretty upset if it was a good movie. Like, if this were Inherent Vice, me I could never see Inherent Vice.
That's true,
I would literally be crying now.
So, I don't know. It's a very bizarre situation. I guess we'll see how it plays out, because it's still not over somehow.
Yeah, it's still going on. Ongoing.
Yeah,
we'll keep you updated on cutprintfilm.com.
Check back on the 8s.
Yes, add our website to your favorites and check back every 8 minutes. Not 8 minutes, every 10 minutes on the 8s.
Sony updates on the 8s.
Traffic on the 2s.
That's right. I don't like any of this.
Well, what do you like?
I like this film we're about to talk about.
Cool.
Yes, we're moving on.
That's right.
I know you haven't heard from us in a while, but we did a Mel Brooks director series, and it didn't go well.
Yeah, because Mel Brooks, even though we all like Mel Brooks, you can't say a lot about his movies.
No. But somebody whose movies you can say a lot about is Mr. Stanley Kubrick.
That's right.
Who is what we're going to be focusing on for the next few shows.
On our director series. And hey, do we have any sort of production related to the director series?
Hang on. Let me look inside my top hat.
Director series.
Turn it off, Jeff. That's it. I think that's enough. They've heard enough.
Jeff, you sound so young in that clip.
Oh, it was a simpler time. All right, so
we're kind of. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Don't you dare.
I was going to say that we're kind of doing the Kubrick B-sides.
Right, yeah. So what when we picked the Stanley Kubrick for the director series, we also set a little rule. And the rule rules, plural. And the rules are, we can talk about any of his movies, but we're not going to talk about 2001 A Space Odyssey. We're not going to talk about The Shining.
Yeah.
Because
they've been talked to death.
What? There's nothing more you can say about those movies at this point.
They've been talked to death on this very show.
Right.
Just in passing.
Yeah.
Right. There's no, I mean, The Shining literally has an entire movie filled with lunatics sprouting lunatic theories about what the film is about.
That's room 237.
Yeah.
Watch it if you dare.
Yeah, watch it for the first 5 minutes and then, this is shit, and then turn it off, as I did. So, yeah, Stanley Kubrick. Would we like to learn a little bit about Stanley Kubrick?
Sure.
All right. I wrote this all myself. I did not copy it from Rotten Tomatoes. As one of the most universally acclaimed and influential directors of the post-war era, Stanley Kubrick enjoyed a reputation and a standing unique among the filmmakers of his day. A perennial outsider, he worked far beyond the confines of Hollywood, maintaining complete artistic control and making movies according to the whims and time constraints of no one but himself. But with the rare advantage of studio financial support for all of his endeavors. Working in a vast range of styles and genres spanning from black comedy to horror to crime drama, Kubrick was an enigma, living and creating in almost total seclusion, far away from the watchful eye of the media.
All right, yeah, Kubrick was a strange duck.
There really isn't a lot. I can't think of another filmmaker like Stanley Kubrick, where he made basically mainstream non-mainstream movies. Mm-hmm. They were outsider movies that somehow were in the mainstream.
And this is going to sound like a little absurd, but the only person I can like think of who does a similar thing in that sense, not
John Favreau. Was that John Favreau, the director of Chef?
No, it wasn't him. Oh. In the sense that he's doing stuff that shouldn't normally be done as Tarantino.
Right. Like,
I can see that.
Because, like you said, making non-mainstream stuff mainstream. Like, yeah. Nobody wants to see a fucking Western nowadays, but he can make it awesome.
And I would say, while he's not on the same level, I'd say like Christopher Nolan falls sort of into that, where he makes very mainstream movies that are close to being non-mainstream, even though they aren't.
He makes very heady movies,
right, yeah.
Much like
that,
Kubrick did.
That somehow end up being blockbusters. Yeah.
All right, so Eyes Wide Shut...
Normally we go in sequential order, but since this is our Christmas episode, we're going to start with Kubrick's final film.
And boy, is it Christmassy.
Yeah, yes. This is
probably the most Christmassy movie that's ever been released.
Yeah.
Santa Claus is in it, there's elves, there's an orgy.
Yeah.
But there almost is not a single scene in the movie without Christmas lights in the shot somewhere.
There's almost a Christmas tree in almost every scene of this film, and it's gorgeous, too. I just loved just the seeing those trees.
Yeah, and you said Kubrick maintained complete control,
right.
But this is the one film where he didn't have final cut because he was dead.
Right, although he did deliver basically his cut 6 days before he died to Warner Brothers. Right.
Good for him.
Did they release it, his cut?
Well, what happened was,
or did they just throw it in the trash?
Basically, the cut that was released is his cut with one glaring exception is... During a orgy scene late in the film, Warner Brothers basically digitally inserted people in robes standing in front of the people fucking. So it's not on... There's two versions of the film. There's the unrated version, which is the version that's on HBO Go currently.
Which is what we've all seen.
Right. Which is uncut. You can see all that fucking. And then there's the version...
There's a lot of uncut stuff in that one.
That's right.
There's a version where it's really weird. It's like... terrible. It's basically
Gentiles.
If you remember the Austin Powers films, there was this running gag where when Austin Powers is naked, people keep holding up fruit to block his sexual organs. That's what it looked like in Eyes Wide Shut.
Yes.
Where instead of like fruit, it's people in robes just oddly standing in front of all the action.
Yeah, so
that sounds absurd.
Yeah, it's really distracting. It's really weird.
Eyes Wide Shut came out in 1999,
yes.
And it stars Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman as a married couple, and they were married at the time, and they were all over the tabloids.
Yeah, they were pretty much Hollywood's biggest couple at the time.
And I believe this is when they were going through the death throes of their marriage.
Right, they got divorced in 2001, so not too far after this film came out.
And you can kind of tell.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just really good chemistry or what, but they have a chemistry and it works particularly well for these roles.
Absolutely. So I'll just do a brief synopsis because this movie is not really narrative focused. It's more about what's it's what's not being implied. There's more to the subtext than there is actual plot.
It's not plot heavy.
Yeah. It basically takes place over the course of 2 days, correct?
Right.
Did everybody else get
Which
that?
Which was kind of jarring when like they first mentioned, like, oh, it's only been a day.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you're like, it seems like so much stuff has happened. Yeah,
the bulk of it happens in one night, really. It's just one long night and then a few things in the next day.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the first two-thirds of the film is that first night. Right. So Tom Cruise stars as Dr. Bill Harford, and Nicole Kidman is his wife, Alice. They're a young New York couple. He is a doctor who they're fairly wealthy. He's made his bones making house calls, as referenced by Nicole Kidman. And they go to a lavish Christmas party thrown by their friend Victor Ziegler, played by Sidney Pollack,
who I love in this.
He's fantastic.
He was a director also.
Yes,
and he has a really natural sort of style.
He's not much of an actor normally, but he was awesome in this.
Yeah,
just wonderful.
It's just like a sort of like natural sort of. He just doesn't seem like he's acting. It's really,
you get like this is an old
like
an old
creep.
He's got old money.
Yeah.
So they go to this party thrown by the Zieglers, and Nicole Kidman's character, Alice, dances with this silver fox.
Yeah, I believe it was Count Dracula she dances with.
Yes, she dances with Leslie Nielsen, this Count Dracula, who flirts and hits on her and tries to have sex with her for approximately 17 hours.
Also, I want to point out that the actor's name is Sky Dumont, which is the smoothest fucking name I've ever heard.
I love that.
He just looks like a guy who would be named Sky Dumont.
While Alice is being drunkenly wooed by this Count Dracula lookalike, Tom Cruise is walking arm in arm with two beautiful models when he is called upstairs to assist Mr. Ziegler in a very, very bad situation. A hooker has passed out from a drug overdose. She thinks she was doing a speedball.
Right.
So Tom Cruise brings her back to life because he can do that type of thing.
Yes, he's a really good doctor.
He's the best. And he and his wife go home. They smoke a little pot, and she acts terribly.
Yeah.
She tells him – this is where she tells him about the sex dream.
Right, yeah. So,
sex fantasy.
So Nicole Kidman apparently has never smoked pot in her life because she's required to act like she's stoned, she basically acts like – I don't know. She's had a stroke or something.
Yes. She's kicking. She's writhing.
She just talks
– I don't know.
Really,
like,
slowly.
I was trying to figure out if like it's
this.
Implied that Sky Dumont – like slips something in her drink.
Maybe?
Because she starts acting very strange suddenly.
If that is it, I kind of appreciate that performance more, but I didn't really pick up on that.
All right, well, let's go back to that
once
I wrap this up. So Tom Cruise throws a fit when she tells him about this sexual fantasy and how she would have thrown her entire life away with him and their daughter for this guy just because he gave her a look.
Right, well, basically, yeah, they were on vacation a long time ago and she saw like a sailor in a bar. And just from the look, she has this whole fantasy about banging this sailor.
Yeah, and we clip to that fantasy being shown.
And Tom Cruise, he's very insecure, so he keeps dwelling on it.
So he flips out and goes for a walk, finds a hooker, doesn't sleep with her.
No.
And then he goes to a nightclub where he meets his old, I get where they were in medical school
together.
Yeah,
they were in med school together.
A piano player named Nick Nightingale. And
it's
Nick.
A fucking smooth name.
That's a great name.
Nick tells him he's got to go. He's got this gig where they blindfold him and he plays. And the last time he was blindfolded, he saw these beautiful naked women. And they just at that moment, he gets a phone call with a password to get into the place. Bill Harford twists his arm to get the password. Mr. Nightingale foolishly gives him the password, which is
Fidelio.
Oh, I love it. And Tom Cruise calls the dirtiest cab he could find to take him to a mansion.
Well, no, first he goes to the creepiest costume shop in town a costume.
How could I forget about Zangief from the Street Fighter series?
The actor's name I can never pronounce. It's like Rage Schauerberg.
Perfect. Yes, he goes. He's told by Nick Nightingale that he needs a costume and a cape and a mask.
Right.
And so he goes to this costume shop where the shop owner's daughter is sleeping with two Chinese food delivery boys.
It's
like two old Chinese men who are wearing makeup. So it's weird from beginning to end.
Yes, they're wearing kabuki makeup.
Yeah, it's very strange.
So he gets the costume. He calls this filthy cab. He drives out into, I guess,
Jersey?
I guess it's like upstate New York.
Yeah,
I would
it
say.
looks upstate New York-y.
Yeah. Okay, I was thinking like South Orange, where it's really...
It could be.
But it kind of like gave me the Gatsby, like West Ham vibe, too.
Yeah, it's this enormous
West
mansion.
Egg, not West Ham.
He gives them the password. They let him in. And that's when things get fucking weird.
Right. It turns into the best Christmas party ever.
That's right. Everyone's in terrifying masks and robes, and there's fucking aplenty.
There's a big orgy going on. There's a guy dressed as a cardinal wearing a mask, slamming a cane on the floor.
There's absolutely bone-chilling music playing. Yeah, it's like there's a guy banging a staff on the ground, naked women everywhere. And one of these naked women comes up to Bill Harford and tells him, get the fuck out of here.
You're in danger.
You have to go. So he doesn't go.
Any normal person would have immediately left.
Oh, yeah. Time to go. Yes. Head for the hills. Jesus. So, yeah, he doesn't leave. And then he gets a message that his cab driver is...
At the gate.
At the gate, and he wants him now. And then that's when my pants fill up with fecal material, because
he's ushered into a room.
Yeah, you think he's being ushered to the cab driver, and he's ushered into a room where everyone in masks is waiting in a circle, and the masks all turn and look at him.
The score, it's
these piano notes.
It's like these single notes.
Oh, my goodness.
Kind of like Kanye West's Runaway.
No,
this is good, though. It's so terrifying. And they call him into the middle of the circle, tell him to take his mask off. Oh, no, they ask him...
The house password.
Yeah, what the house password was.
And smooth Tom Cruise goes... I forgot it. And good one.
And then everybody comically goes, they all
titter.
So, yeah, they tell him to take his mask off.
Which he does. He takes
his mask off. Then they tell him to take his clothes off, and he says, look.
Yeah, this is terrifying.
That's where I draw the line. I won't take my clothes off. And so they tell him that he must pay the price. And that's when the woman who previously warned him volunteers to pay the price for him.
Right. And so Tom Cruise leaves. He's haunted by everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to go about, just his normal life. Then he finds out the next day that the woman is dead, basically. Well, basically, he hears about a woman is dead.
Yeah.
In a morgue. And he puts two and two together that this is probably the woman from the party.
And so he goes looking for Nick Nightingale.
Right.
But he doesn't find Nick Nightingale, but he does find Alan Cumming, who cannot stop drooling and licking his lips.
Alan Cumming is in love with Tom Cruise.
Boy, does he love him.
I love Alan Cumming,
too. He's great. It's such a, like, anyone else, this would be like a throwaway part.
Yeah.
But he's so good in this
one
scene.
He's in this movie for 4 minutes or so, and he's so memorable.
Yeah.
So he finds out from Alan Cumming, who was the bellhop at Nightingale's hotel, that Mr. Nightingale came in with two men and a bruise on his face and left with these men. And those men told him, we'll be collecting his mail. And
it's always a good sign.
Bill Harford gets a little upset and he goes looking for the woman, correct?
Right.
And he goes to the morgue.
Yeah.
And there she is. And it's definitely the woman from the night before.
Right. And then as he's like, what the fuck? He gets summoned by Ziegler to his awesome den where he has a giant red pool table.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, Ziegler tells him, I was at the party last night and you need to knock this shit off. Like, and basically Ziegler lays out for him that nothing really sinister really happened. It's it's just a bunch of rich people fooling around and everything was just basically an act. And the woman, she just died of an overdose. It wasn't nothing.
She was
really
a hooker.
Right. She was the hooker from the beginning of the film. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. He tells her that he says you said it yourself. She would die from it eventually. Okay. So Tom Cruise, he sort of accepts it, but he's sort of like, I don't know. But he goes home, and he's still trying to shake it off. And then the fucking mask, which he couldn't find, is laying on the pillow next to Nicole Kidman, who's asleep.
So he tells her everything.
Right. And oddly enough, it just makes their relationship somehow stronger. And they go out Christmas shopping, and they have a nice little conversation.
A pep talk, if you will.
Yeah, and there's sort of the sort of thing where Nicole Kidman says, maybe it was all a dream, maybe it wasn't. The important thing is we're awake now.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise says, forever. And she says, let's not use that word.
Yeah, let's not be nuts, Tom.
Yes. And then she says, there is
she
one.
She can see 2 years into the future. Yes.
She says,
she's clairvoyant, but not that clairvoyant.
She said, there's one more thing we should do. And he says, what's that? And she says, fuck. And that is the last word ever in a Stanley Kubrick film, ever.
Well, unless you count AI.
No.
Oh.
The last word in that is fuck, too.
That seems highly inappropriate.
I think it was the audience I saw it with saying, fuck, is that it? Even though I like AI, yeah, just for the record. Yeah, anyway, right.
All right, so lots to talk about here.
Yeah.
And not so much. I know that plot synopsis went on for a while, but there's not much plot.
Yeah, it's just scenes.
It's a long movie. Yeah. This is about 2.5 hours.
Yeah, 2 hours and 38 minutes, okay. Actually.
But, it's more long shots, and that's what makes the length in this film. There's not a whole lot of plot going on. This is basically sexual tension, the movie.
Right. It's just like insecurities and sexual tension thrown up on the screen. Yeah. Like,
it sticks with Tom Cruise the whole movie.
Yeah, it's more his movie.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Except for the beginning, right?
Now, yeah, where you get that long Nicole Kidman scene.
So when this movie was coming out, this was a hugely hyped movie when it was being made. And it basically had just like this myth growing up around it. And it has the Guinness World Record for the longest movie shoot ever. It took 400 days to make this film.
Oh my God.
And it was 400 consecutive days, no breaks, that Stanley Kubrick shot this film.
Well, how long had it been since he made a movie when he made this?
I don't know.
I guess I'm pretty sure it was a while. And
I think the movie before this was Full Metal Jacket. And it was like the 80s.
Oh, wow.
So that's probably why the hype was so big.
It was.
Because you had the two biggest movie stars.
It was Kubrick working with the two biggest movie stars. And also, the thing the media focused on a lot was that there was going to be a lot of sex in this movie. And when it came out, a lot of critics were like, oh, that wasn't sexy at all. And because they're missing the point of the movie, and it's not supposed to be sexy.
Yeah, this is about the ugliness of sex and the fallout from flirting and insecurities between and, like, couples.
Even when you get to the orgy scene, it's the most cold orgy you've ever seen.
It's just so clinical.
It's just people just like... not even rhythmically fucking. They're just like doing it, and they're all wearing masks, so there's no emotion. And
there's nothing hot about this movie.
No, and that's intentional, and it threw everyone off because all the hype before the movie came out was like, this is a big sex movie.
Yeah.
And this was the last movie my parents ever told me I couldn't see. I was right on that cusp of like, I'm too old for that now, but because there was so much hype about sex in this movie, my mom was like, you're not seeing that. And, of course, that made me want to see it even more. So
we showed her.
Yeah.
Now we're doing a podcast.
Yeah, I just watched it last night, Mom.
What do you think about the interactions between Cruise and Kidman in the apartment in the beginning of the film while they're smoking pot? I know you talked about her having the convulsions.
Yeah, it was just weird. I like it because, they play off each other really well, which I guess because they were married, so they better have, or else it would have been really weird. But Dave, what do you want to see? You look like you have something.
I feel like they're great, especially before the party, like the opening scene.
I thought that was wonderful. Yeah. And she asked him, how do I look? He's not even looking at her.
Yeah,
you look great.
There's a shot which it's kind of striking, just because like basically he's getting ready and she's just on the toilet, and that's like the perfect way to illustrate how just like
married they are.
Because that's just, it's just weird, even to married people.
It's a lived-in relationship.
Yeah.
But neither of them felt like that kid's parent, which I guess maybe like was like the upper-class vibe of it, because they do have like a nanny, right?
Right. Well, one of the biggest themes of the film is how, I'm not going to say out of touch, but just how like these two characters, they're wealthy, they're basically above everything, and by the end of the film, Tom Cruise has been sort of like brought back down to being like, oh, I'm not the hot shit I thought.
Yeah, well, because he discovers another level of wealth above him.
Right, like as high up as you think he is, and he has this gorgeous giant apartment and all this stuff, and he runs around the whole movie flashing his doctor's badge like he's a cop. And so basically, he thinks he's this great, he thinks he's as high as he can get.
And then he spends the whole film getting knocked down, whether it's by the fact that there's a class above him that he had no idea about, and also the fact that there's a group of frat guys that call him faggot and threaten him.
Right, yeah.
And they're just like your everyday guys. They pull him, knock him down a peg. He meets this hooker, Domino, and later finds out that she has HIV.
Right.
And he almost slept with her. That pulls him back down in another notch.
I love that hooker scene because you can tell – I love the way – Tom Cruise is really good in this movie. I love that hooker scene because you can tell the character is trying to be so fucking smooth and he just sounds like a dork. And I loved that.
Yeah.
But jumping back to Nicole Kidman and Tom, their relationship, because as you know, even though they're both high class, I also love that like it's Nicole Kidman earlier in the film. She says she used to run an art gallery, but she doesn't have that job anymore. So basically, she's like a housewife now, and you can tell she doesn't want to be that. So she's basically dependent on her husband's money.
Yeah.
And it was a great, like, it's just like a power dynamic between them. So.
So did you get I know this is, we weren't going to talk about The Shining too much, but there's like a real Shining vibe to those early scenes. Oh, yeah.
I think there's a Shining vibe to a lot of scenes in the film.
Yeah.
Be it the apartment they're in or the mansion that the orgy takes place in, or the party that they go to,
which just feels like Overlook Hotel ballroom.
Yeah. Right, she might as well be dancing with Lloyd
Grady.
Grady.
But I would say that Eyes Wide Shut of all Kubrick's movie recalls The Shining most in the most way, because it's just like those striking hallway shots and the Steadicams, and it's always at like you're always like two steps behind Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Which reminded me a lot of Birdman, which I, you know, recalls The Shining too.
Yeah.
I will say another Shining thing is when he does walk into that room where everybody's got masks on, when he thinks he's going to meet his cab driver and they all turn and look at him, that brings to mind the scene in The Shining where the two twin girls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the corner.
It's as terrifying. It might even be more terrifying than the two twin girls. Yeah. It really, that scene really scared the shit out of me the other night.
It's just an unsettling movie. And I love the Christmas time setting. That somehow makes it more unsettling, somehow.
New York's definitely a character in the film.
Right. Even though it's clearly backlot New York.
Yeah, most definitely. But you get the vibe of, you know, Manhattan.
Yeah.
This is in Manhattan. And
weird 90s Manhattan, too.
Yeah.
And I loved the... I said it already, but I just love how... I love how Kubrick just keeps highlighting how Tom Cruise's character just thinks like money fixes everything. Cause I think he drops like 10 grand in this one night. He runs around. He gives like the cab driver $100 bill.
He has so much cash.
Yeah, he's just constantly giving people money. Like he goes to get the costume and cause it's after hours, and he says, I'll give you $100 for above the price and I'll give you an extra. So he buys the costume and he gives an extra $200.
Yeah.
For fucking a one night thing.
The prostitute Domino, he gives her the money even though he doesn't sleep with her.
Yeah.
Because he gets a phone call from his wife.
Yeah. Right.
I like that scene where he's like talking about how he has to go. And he's like, yep, I think I do have to go.
I love that scene.
That's such a great line.
It's one of my favorite scenes in the film just because it's so. I just loved how much of a dork he was in that scene. And
I really. This performance that Tom Cruise gives is really fantastic. It's the strongest performance in the entire film.
It is.
It's a very like passive performance, and I like that about it, because like you could kind of fit yourself in that role.
It almost reminded me of his most recent strong performance in Edge of Tomorrow, where again he's this guy who thinks he's slick and he's not.
Yeah,
and he's really good at playing that.
And isn't that all of us? Like,
yes.
Don't we all think we're a little slicker than we actually are?
Yeah, when you get like
a bunch of rowdy boys come and yell at us.
Yes.
Call us gay on the street. And
just in my own house.
They just break in. Hey!
Well, that's what's cool about Kubrick's filmmaking is you get that two steps behind him point of view where you're watching this guy act cool from just slightly like arm's length, and you could see that it's not as cool. And like you get that feeling from that scene where he gets pushed over by those guys where it's like, oh, thank God no one else is around to see this.
To see him humiliated.
Because he recovers pretty quickly from it.
Yeah, and it would be exactly how I would recover.
Yeah.
You'd stumble and look at him and be like, now I got to get out of here.
And it's just, the whole movie is just, it's just...
Go back to San Francisco where you belong.
Yeah. very natural dialogue
that. That's how men on the street yell, I believe. And just the whole movie, it's just basically Tom Cruise's insecurities coming back to haunt him. Like, the whole thing that sets the movie off, this journey off, is his wife hasn't even been unfaithful. No. She just says she had a fantasy about it.
And he can't handle
it. Yeah, he's such an insecure jerk off that he's like, I can't take it. And so he goes out in the night. One of his patients dies and he goes to the house. And the daughter kisses him and she's like, I love you. And he says, we have had like two conversations. I barely know you. And you can tell he wants to cheat on his wife, basically just to get back at her, because that's how. And it's sort of like he wants, in his own twist, he wants to like reclaim his manhood.
He either wants to cheat on her or he wants to know that he has the option to do that.
Yeah, he wants to basically just prove that in his own world he's still like a man. Like,
right,
he,
right.
He feels like his manhood has been robbed and he's like, I gotta get out there and bang someone to prove I'm still top shit.
Yeah,
similar to those tones in Force Majeure.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Like, did you see that?
I have yet to watch
Force Majeure. It has like a similar tone where Force Majeure is a little more comedic, right. but like it's the same like struggle, I would say.
To just like prove but your manhood.
I would say that Nicole Kidman is really sadistic in how she...
Think so?
It's pretty mean.
It's
venom in there.
It's sort of justified because the reason she brings it up is because... At the party, Tom Cruise is walking around with two girls on his arm and basically...
disappeared. Yeah.
Right. And so she's sort of like a
but
little...
But I mean, who hasn't done that?
Who hasn't walked on Tom Cruise's arm at a party?
I just did it right after my wife gave birth. To the hospital.
Two nurses came up and you're like, let's stroll around, ladies. Yeah. So basically she brings it up to him and he's like, well, the only reason men and women are friends is because men want to bang every woman they talk to.
It's just like, what?
And so I guess she's sort of being sadistic about it, but I think it's sort of warranted because he's being a caveman in his logic.
Yeah, he's giving her some caveman theory.
But then she does it again later in the film when she brings up the dream and then goes to the next level.
I guess in that level, it is.
Just like, cool it, lady.
I love that scene, too, because he comes in after this wild goddamn night. And Nicole McKimmon's asleep, and she's, like, giggling in her sleep. And he wakes her up, and she's like, oh, I was having the worst nightmare, even though she was just, like, laughing her ass off. I just love the
it's
way
It's almost
that.
like you were saying, like, he's on this quest to regain his manhood, and he goes through all this shit and comes home, and then it's totally undone
right.
he's, by her.
He's even weaker
giggling.
Than he was before he left, basically. Yeah. So
That's a cool point. You want to talk about this more after the break?
Let's take a break. We'll talk about it more, and then we're going to talk about some Christmas movies.
Yes. It's our favorites.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of cutprintfilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do. It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
Your mask.
Merry Christmas. Take off all of your clothes. You are deep to the darkness. I was born in it. Welcome to Bane's Orgy. Where's the trigger?
Welcome back, everybody. We're doing Bane impressions.
Yeah, you'll never get enough Bane jokes on Cutprint Film.
Okay.
Who's Bane?
So we were just talking about Eyes Wide Shut. Who's Bane? Bane is that great band. Haven't you ever heard them?
Yes. No, that's Train you're thinking of. Oh. They did that hit song, Meet Virginia.
So yeah, we were talking about Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut as part of our director series, Dave giggles.
That music you just heard is the...
My favorite song.
Yes, it's...
I do just love that, just because it's just disturbing. Yeah. Basically what that is, it's a song in Romanian that is then played backwards to make it extra disturbing.
And that's what you hear when Tom Cruise enters this orgy scene mansion.
Yeah, there's a man in the middle. He's dressed like a cardinal, mm-hmm. a red robe. He's slamming his stick down, and all these women, they disrobe, and then they kiss each other with their masks on. It's just weird.
It's strange music, because like, whenever I go to an orgy, it's like...
it's always house music.
Yeah.
David Guetta's playing.
Whenever I go, it's just Weird Al music. And Ortiz. I don't know why. It's that song. It's that 10-minute song Albuquerque he recorded. That's just
boy,
like,
I can't get enough of Weird Al. He's so culturally relevant.
Especially at orgies.
Okay.
So, eyes wide shut. So, let's talk a little about the orgy scene. Let's talk about what we think the ending means.
Okay. So, this orgy scene, it's full of dread from the gates of the building.
Oh, it's just,
there's a bad feeling in my stomach the second he gets out of the taxi.
Yeah, he pulls up and the guard is like, oh, good evening. And
I love this scene because he says like, should I give you the password?
Yeah, he's like, I guess you want the password.
If you wish.
He's like, if you wish, sir. Yeah. Like it's just so, I don't know, it's strange.
No one at this party is acting natural, basically.
No.
So it's just, it's unsettling.
And so, these masks, these grotesque masks.
Yeah. It's just nightmare. His mask is it's just a sort of simple blank face, but everyone else has these hard, there's like a moon face and all these just weird Picasso faces, basically.
So one of the guys was definitely Sky Dumont, right? The guy who looks at him from up top.
I kind of get the feeling that everyone at this party is everyone he ran into in the movie.
That's what I get the feeling.
Even the costume guy is there. Just everyone is there.
I know the costume guy is not there, but right. I did get that feeling.
That sort of feeling where just if everyone took off the mask and revealed it was everyone from the movie, I'd be like, that makes sense. I saw that coming, mm-hmm. sort of.
Then what's the problem with Tom Cruise being there?
I think the problem is that it's, again, even though he's rich, he's not as rich as these people are.
Right. This is a power player's society.
Yeah, but the hooker's there. She's not rich.
Yeah, but they're paid to be there, basically.
She's there, as Ziegler said, to get her brains fucked out.
Yeah, all the women there, they're hookers being paid.
That's why Tom Cruise was there, too, though.
Well, yeah, that's true.
He was there to get his brains fucked out?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that's sort of the taboo, is that Tom Cruise, even though he's rich, he's not as rich as these people. He's not as powerful as these people. He's still sort of a servant to them because they call on him to come.
Right. Oh, great point.
Yeah.
He is. He's a public servant as far as they're concerned.
Yeah. As rich of a doctor as he is, he still makes house. They make a point pointing out that he makes house calls.
He has to work.
Yeah.
Essentially.
He's a rich doctor, but these people won't even come to see him in his fucking office. He has to go to their mansions, basically, to treat them.
That brings to mind Downton Abbey, where they make this big deal about one of the characters being a lawyer and how ridiculous it is that he works.
Right.
What type of life is that to live?
Yeah, and that's what... Yeah, because these people, they're not...
I think you just... summed up a big, you filled a big hole in this movie for me by saying
I just cracked the case.
You did. You've cracked it wide open, Pollock.
But that's an interesting parallel, too, because he's actually he's doing the same thing. He's going to their house.
Right.
To this party,
But they didn't ask him to come.
Yeah.
So he's crashing the gate. And so that's sort of the thing. And they're just you didn't. So, yeah, basically. The scene where he's found out is just, that's like anxiety somehow personified in film. Just like the way it's shot in this aerial shot where you see him encircled and it's hundreds of people all in masks and robes and he's just in the middle. And just like that that weird sort of take off your clothes thing is just upsetting. It's just to hear that. Like if I were at a party and someone surrounded me and to take off your clothes, I'd be screaming and running out of there.
The upsetting thing about it is that there's a version of this movie where the girl doesn't save him and something entirely different happens. That, what is it? What happens to Tom Cruise when they rip his clothes off?
Oh, if it had gone that way. Well, that ties into the ending then. So, what do you guys think about Sidney Pollack's explanation, basically? Do you think that's really what happened? Or
No.
You think there's more to it?
Yeah.
I think because Tom Cruise is looked at as below them.
Right.
What do you think a hooker is considered? That is just garbage to them, for them to throw away.
Right.
They killed that woman.
I think.
And Nick Nightingale, he is a monkey that plays music for them. They killed him.
Yeah, the big giveaway there is Nick Nightingale's mail, because why would they care about his mail? Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean?
Why wouldn't they say forward it to his house?
Yeah.
It's And this is, again, it's how great Sidney Pollack's performance is in this film, because he sounds so believable.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he sounds, and like at one point he's like, all right.
He's shrugging his shoulders, he's shaking his head, he's like, what the fuck?
And at one point he's like, let's cut the shit. And there's one thing he says that gives it away that maybe he's not telling the truth, and it's before he gives the whole scenario about it being an act, he says, suppose I told you none of this was, and like, the fact that he says that sort of makes it sort of like, oh, maybe he's still bullshit.
Yeah, like, can we just pretend it's fake?
Yeah.
Like, that's
basically how he's phrasing it. It's like, let's just pretend everything I'm telling you is bullshit.
Which is an interesting thing, because you're saying a hooker's nothing and Nick Nightingale is nothing, but that seems like what the conundrum is from their point of view, is that they can't just kill Tom Cruise because he's a respected doctor.
Exactly, yeah.
What do they do with him? They have
someone would notice.
Yeah.
So they have to lie to him. And I guess that sort of makes the ending, even though it is an upbeat ending, it's also kind of dark, because you know, he reconciles with Nicole Kidman, and basically she sort of just says, like, well, let's just ignore all that stuff that just happened, basically.
Okay, yeah. How do you read that, The Mask?
So you can either read it as
she finds the mask.
She finds it and left it there. They as in the...
Or they snuck in and left it
or
there.
Or even, it's not even really there. Because she wakes up...
I think it's not even there.
And she doesn't even acknowledge it. Basically, he sees it, he breaks down, and him crying wakes up Nicole Kidman. But she doesn't, like... Like, if I woke up and there was a mask on my pillow, I'd probably look at that mask first.
I'd punch it and bite it.
So, then does it go to the next level where it's, like, The Shining and none of it's really there?
I'd say the stuff he saw did happen. I just think he's so overwhelmed that his mind is just, like, fucking making him see a mask that's not really there. Because he returns the costume to the shop and he doesn't have the mask anymore. And he doesn't know what happened to it. And I sort of think it's just not really on that pillow. I think he's just sort of having a mental break.
Okay.
Because he's had one long, crazy night, so...
Yeah, I'm just letting that sink in, because I didn't think of it as... It never crossed my mind that it wasn't actually there, and that's really interesting,
like,
to me.
If Nicole Kidman had acknowledged it at some point, I would not think that. But the fact that she doesn't even look at it suggests to me that it's not really there.
I just thought it was like he thought he was caught.
Right.
And told her.
Right.
But I don't know. It's a strange scene because it just cuts to her on the couch.
I mean, it's deliberately open-ended, because that's how Kubrick liked to do things. Like, he didn't want to give you every answer.
Yeah.
And I sort of read the ending as Tom Cruise he's feeling better about himself, and he realizes where his place is in the order of things.
Mm-hmm. And he's come clean about everything. There are no pretenses anymore between him and his wife.
Right.
Because, you know, before, how do I look? He's not even looking at her. You look fine. Now they're being honest with one another, and it's a relief.
Yeah, it's almost like he had slid into a routine and took her for granted. Now it's like, after experiencing this crazy shit, he realizes, like...
It's almost like the whole night was like therapy for him, basically. Yeah. All his demons were worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, if you do take it as... They were the cult, if you want to call them a cult, they were lying and they really did kill the prostitute. It's a dark ending, because he's left
death in his wake. Everyone that he met that night has died will die.
And you can tell he still sort of thinks like Ziegler was lying, and he still sort of thinks, oh, it did really happen the way I think it happened. And basically, and Nicole Kidman knows this, and she's also just saying, like, let's just forget it. Who cares that that prostitute died, basically? Let's just go on with our lives.
Let's just go home and fuck.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what she wants.
Yeah.
She's got to have it.
She wants to fuck the pain away like that Peaches song.
Yes.
Were you ever worried for a second that Nicole Kidman was going to be part of the cult?
Who's to say she wasn't there in a mask? Who knows? You never know.
I never got that thought.
I got the thought, but because it's Kubrick, I was like, that won't happen.
Yeah.
But it did worry me for a second. I was like,
I feel like that would have been too much of like a movie twist. Where like,
yeah.
Like she like, he's like, thank God that's over. And then she calls someone and she's like, he believes all of it. And she hangs up.
Okay.
And then like it irises out on her winking at the camera. Tell him.
That leads to my next question, which is, did you get the impression that there's more movie here? That's not. Like, that you don't see?
Oh, yeah, there's a million things going on that we don't... The whole movie is from Tom Cruise's point of view, so who knows how many times these people get together and have their wild orgies.
It just felt like too much of a... And not this is a negative thing, but just like a glancing blow almost. Like you're not seeing
it. See, I kind of love that because I love that the movie hints that there's this whole other world that Tom Cruise, he's only basically like scratched the surface of. And he could have kept digging and found out more about it, but basically Sidney Pollack is like, fucking let it go. And he does.
Yeah, that it's a very good movie. Yeah. And after talking about it, I appreciate it more.
Oh, yeah. My wife hated it when we watched it. I'm curious.
Well, that's because you're always going to those orgies with those masks.
I can't help myself. I have all these masks. I got to put them to use.
I got one for every night.
My wife loved it, but she loves all Kubrick's movies, so it's like...
No, mine does too. She just didn't like this one, but we haven't really discussed it.
It's a polarizing film. I could definitely see, like I said, when I watched it for the first time... Was this the first time she had seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah, when I watched it the first time, I didn't really like it, but...
It almost seems pointless at first viewing.
Yeah, like,
unless you think about, like, oh, wait a second, there's more to this than there's the plot, because there's almost no plot, and the plot itself is kind of really bizarre.
Right.
So there is something sexy about the movie, though. Like,
oh yeah, I mean,
well, the opening scenes of Nicole Kidman are absolutely
There's like this
one of the most erotic things I've ever seen in film.
And even like when they keep flashing to the fantasy that Tom Cruise keeps having of her with sailor, that's very like seductively filmed. Like it's like a cold sexiness.
Yeah, it's a strange blend that kind of like it's repulsive and. It's like taboo almost.
It's sort of like if you're into that sort of thing, it's really sexy.
Like, and like we said, there's sexual tension in just about every scene aside from the one with him and Sidney Pollack at the end.
Right.
There's sexual tension throughout when he meets with Domino the hooker, when he meets with her roommate later on in the film. There's sexual tension.
Yeah, the whole movie.
The costume guy's daughter.
Yeah. The costume guy's daughter.
The whole movie is Tom Cruise encountering women in some sort of sexual... situation, like the daughter of the dead patient kisses him. The daughter of the costume guy is like clearly flirty with him.
He's got two women on his arm.
Oh, we've got to put him out that where Tom Cruise goes back to the costume guy, and basically, even though the costume guy was screaming at these men, he's now perfectly okay with it, and it's implied that he's basically pimping his daughter out, which is an insane sort of thing.
Another thing, not more misery in Tom Cruise's wake.
Yeah.
Yeah, what is that scene?
I don't understand.
Her face is so hard to read because she's like...
I think she's mentally ill.
Is that what it is?
She never really talks.
She looks dead in the eyes. There's a mental illness or something going on there.
Because she's whispering to him the whole time, but you're not privy to what she's saying.
And, I mean, that scene basically that's there to make Tom... Like, that's sort of the scene that makes Tom Cruise be like, I gotta find out about more what happened last night. Because he would have probably just dropped it, but just seeing... The costume guy go from this, like, oh, you defiled my daughter, to being like, it's fine. He's like, well, I need to check my priorities.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Christmas in it.
I love it. Yeah, a lot of trees.
Like we said.
Santa Claus shows up.
Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, he's at the orgy, I believe.
All right. So, yeah, I guess that's our discussion on Eyes Wide Shut. So, what are we going to be talking about next week?
Do you want to go back to the beginning? We're going to start in order now for
sure.
Kubrick. All right. We're going to be talking about The Killing, which is one of Kubrick's.
I want to feel your bones on my bones.
I don't know what we're doing.
I don't know what's happening there. But anyway.
Dave, I don't know if you have
it's the killers.
Sort of Tourette's.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, not the AMC show that got canceled 10 times. Yeah,
or the band, The Killers, which is not even the same word.
You're using a different tense of kill. I don't
Okay.
All right. Speaking of how much we hate Dave, it's Christmas time. So let's talk about our favorite Christmas film, shall we, gents?
Let's.
And even least favorite if we have one of those.
Yeah, well, I think we all have a least favorite Christmas movie. Yeah.
So when Christmas time comes around, what do you guys find yourselves you have to watch every year, basically?
Dave, you want
to
go first?
Well, I make a point to, like, when I come home Christmas Eve night to put on It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
That's Christmas movie.
Right. I agree. I love that movie.
Right.
And it always shocks me how goddamn long it is.
Oh, it's like, I think it's like 7 hours long.
It's a long movie, but.
Because I think there's like 2 hours before it's even Christmas. It's just like telling his whole life story.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's Christmas.
I always forget that.
Yeah.
I always forget the origin.
The childhood.
Yes.
And there are years where I've just cut right to the bridge scene.
It's like
and watched it from
it's
there.
It's like a novel in film form, basically.
Yeah. It's, I love that movie. Jimmy Stewart is. Just
he's great.
God, he's so good. He's just likable.
That's one of those movies. It's like it's a classic for a reason. Like there are some movies that are classics. You watch them, and you're just like, eh. But that you watch, you're like, oh, I get why this is a classic.
Yeah, it hits, it pulls all the right heartstrings. Right. It's a good movie.
It's one of the greatest movies of all time, I'd say.
Probably.
The top 10.
I'd agree.
I don't know if I'd say top 10, but it's definitely a great.
It's definitely, if I wrote a book, 1001 movies you should watch before you die, I would include it, I'm
8
sure.
8 million films to
wow,
watch
you should write
you
that.
Die.
I don't think anyone has.
All right. So you watch that every Christmas Eve?
Yeah, and I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory why that's a great movie.
Right.
But it has like that cool Twilight Zone feeling to it. What are we, 25 years before the Twilight Zone existed at that point, which makes it awesome.
Yeah, there's probably like 20 Twilight Zone episodes that have the same premise as this movie.
Yeah, I believe. Well, the ending of It's a Wonderful Life, it's he's a robot, right?
Yeah.
No, okay. The ending is... He's like, what planet have we been on? Oh, yeah. And then someone goes, it turns out it's Earth.
Everyone else dies, but his reading glasses are broken.
Oh, okay. Shit.
See, that makes sense now. I get it.
It's a conundrum.
Every year, I think the movie I have to watch, and I've yet to watch it this year, so I should remedy that this week, is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Yes.
I know everybody loves this movie. I know everybody else probably watches it too, but... I never get tired of laughing at the same goddamn jokes.
That's my, of all the vacation movies, that's my favorite, honestly.
It's so good. I mean, next to Vegas Vacation, that.
Oh, you can't beat that.
A modern classic.
Mm, yeah.
The cool thing about that movie is that after you've seen it 1,000 times from watching it every year, when you watch it again the next year, there's something
you missed.
There's a joke that you didn't catch before.
I call it the Ghostbusters effect, where there's so many jokes that you're laughing over them.
And
it's like you said, now you're not going to laugh maybe as hard as you would at the other joke, but you catch something else. So.
And that joke is insanely funny because you never heard it before.
Right.
And,
or even, it might have just been a look Chevy Chase gives.
Right.
It's more the facial gestures in that film.
Yeah, especially with Beverly D'Angelo. She does a lot of just cheerful looks.
Yeah, pretty much like the whole cast in that movie does a really good, even like the kids or even like Juliette Lewis actually has good comic timing in that movie.
Johnny Galecki's good.
Yeah, it's just, it's also one of those movies that you watch a million times when you're a kid and you watch it as an adult and you catch more jokes because you're an adult now.
You also relate to the Chevy Chase character more as an adult.
It's a fucking mean movie.
It is.
My favorite line in the movie is when he's like, Griswold, where are you going to put that tree? And he's like, why don't you bend over and I'll show you.
Well, and then he says, you have a lot of nerve. And he says, I wasn't talking to you.
Yeah.
Implying that he's talking to Elaine Benes.
Yes. And, I miss when Chevy Chase was funny because he's not anymore.
He's so good. Fletch.
Yeah.
The vacation movies.
Like you watch.
A miserable human now.
He is. And like you watch Christmas Vacation, and he's not only is he funny, but he's like a good actor in that film.
Yeah.
And now he's just, you know, a turd. Yeah. I don't know what happened to him.
But yeah, that's the movie I watch every year. I never get tired of it. The Christmas lights thing. Chevy Chase in this. Clark W. Griswold is my stepfather, Don.
I could see that.
It's just the attitude, the try and make everything perfect, and then things just go wrong. My stepdad, 1 year, got so pissed off at the Christmas lights on the Christmas tree that instead of taking them down, he just unplugged them and threw the entire tree outside with the lights rather than put them away. So, things like that, it hits home with me.
That's funny,
significantly.
Man. How about you, Chris?
So I'm a big
Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut. I'm a big fan of incidental Christmas movies, which is movies that aren't actually Christmas movies. They're just set on Christmas. So
you like that with Halloween too, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I just like it when it's in the background sort of, because like Christmas is sort of like Halloween. It's a time of year, and I just like when films encapsulate that. So every year I try and watch both Die Hard and Die Hard 2. Now I know a lot of people shit on Die Hard 2, and I'll get to why I like it in a minute, but. Die Hard 1 has this great sort of just like Christmas being turned upside down feel to it, where it's set on Christmas Eve, and John McClane, he goes to L.A. where it's not very Christmassy because L.A., it's like 80 degrees all the time there, basically. And I know there's just all these nice little Christmas sort of touches to them, and I love that to it. And the reason I like Die Hard 2 is because
it's so different from the first one.
Yeah, it's completely different movie. Like a lot of people don't like Die Hard 2 because it is just it's a rehash. But I love that I love that it's set on an airport on Christmas Eve, and I love that this has that has a more Christmassy feel to it because it's snowing and it's just an airport on Christmas Eve. It's just a nightmare in general, but it's an airport with terrorists around, and there's a scene where there's like a snowmobile chase and he stabs someone in the eye with an icicle. It's all this like it's this corny shit that you just you know some, when they were writing it, they were like, well, it's a Christmas movie, we've got to have all this stuff in it, stuff like that.
Yeah, I like the idea of an incidental Christmas movie.
Yeah, and yeah. I love like Shane Black is a writer who does that a lot with his movies. He wrote the first Lethal Weapon takes place during Christmas, even though it's you know it doesn't have to. And I've talked about it before, this movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is set on Christmas time, which is just a funny fucking movie.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
And I also love A Christmas Carol. I pretty much like all versions of A Christmas Carol except Scrooge, which I wrote about on Cutprint Film, which is the musical one, which is atrocious.
Yeah, not the Bill Murray Scrooge.
No, which I love, film. Even though that also is a movie that doesn't hold up.
As no, well. It doesn't.
Like that whole sequence with I think her name is Carol Kane as the Ghost of Christmas Present is just
irritating.
A nightmare with her. She's just shrieking her performance. But that's a movie just like I still love it just because I have to love it, sort of.
Yeah.
But one thing I watched this year, which I hadn't seen since I was a kid, because they added it to Netflix, was The Muppet Christmas Carol. Yeah,
that is so good.
That is a charming film. And my God.
I watched that for the first time this year as well. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah, I had seen it when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, it's on Netflix, let's watch it, because my wife had never seen it, and I was just like, this is enchanting.
That
and
was, besides Gremlins, that was my favorite Christmas movie as a child, was The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Michael Caine is my favorite Ebenezer Scrooge.
He's so good.
It's just this warm performance, even though Ebenezer Scrooge is, he's a bad guy in the beginning, but he is just, I don't know, there's something about this performance.
I think what makes it so great is Michael Caine is such a, like that warmth is there that a lot of Christmas Carol adaptations, when Scrooge is at the end, he's like, I'm happy, you sort of don't buy it.
It's exactly.
But with Michael Caine, you can see that, oh, there is a warmth there, and when at the end, when he becomes nice, it's less of a, like, trick.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Because, like, the ghosts are pretty much blackmailing Scrooge, basically. It's like, you better be nice or you will die. And it's like, oh, shit. But with Michael Caine's performance, you're like, oh, he was a nice guy.
It's also, like, the best look. Like, that Victorian Muppet.
Oh, I love it.
London looks great.
And the idea of making a character like Gonzo, Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's fantastic because Gonzo's an insane character, and you would really have to shoehorn him in as a Dickens character. But to make him Dickens and narrate, and along with Rizzo the Rat, they just have almost all the good lines.
Yeah, I loved how just like meta it was, just like that those characters.
And what was it, 94 came out?
I think so. That was the first Muppet film after Jim Henson had died, so it was sort of like a big deal.
It's so good.
It is.
And these ghosts, they're like almost the coolest versions of the ghosts too.
Yeah,
like,
that Ghost of Christmas Present is wonderful. Awesome.
Yeah.
And the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come is terrifying.
Yes, it is.
That's all. That was always my favorite ghost when I was a kid because I love creepy bullshit. So yeah, those films particular. And you mentioned Gremlins.
I mean, I would watch Gremlins in the middle of the summer, all that. Like I, as a kid, I probably annoyed the shit out of my parents watching Gremlins. I would like stand next to the TV and recite it word for word.
I believe on cutprintfilm.com, there's a piece about Gremlins coming soon.
Yes, my oral history of the Gremlins.
Go
will
on.
Be. It's not actually called The Gremlins, but
it's called The Gremlins Movie.
It's Wes Anderson's The Gremlins.
It's an extensive oral history that I've been putting together for weeks now, so that should be up sometime this week.
I'm excited to read that.
All right.
It's no Gremlins 2, the new batch.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, which I don't like. And people love that.
It's no Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's whatever. Whatever that fucking thing is.
Cousin Eddie's Starfuckers, I believe it's called.
It's no Muppet's Christmas Carol 2.
No, there isn't one of those.
Okay.
There's actually really no need. They've pretty much solved everything by the end of the
first
one.
I'm just picturing what that movie could
be.
The
demons of Christmas past come, and they try to convince Scrooge to be bad again.
It's a total reversal of the film.
Boy, that stinks.
Like, this is depressing.
That really stinks.
Scrooge be bad again. All right.
I get you guys want to recommend some movies?
Hell yeah, I said.
Okay.
Cumberfilm Weekly Movie Picks. Cumberfilm Weekly Movie Picks.
Holy shit.
I like how you run out of breath at the end of that one.
A new Christmas classic.
My goodness. Boy, that was terrific, Dave.
You've outdone yourself.
Thanks, guys.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
All right. Who wants to go first? I guess I will.
Oh, I vote Jeff.
Okay. My pick is...
Wait, what are we doing?
Oh, these are our movie picks, Dave. Didn't you hear the great song you did?
We're doing a Pollyanna. Come on. What about your gift?
All right.
Oh, here it is.
Put that away. Those children listening.
Why?
I don't know.
My parents are punishing them. You were bad. Go listen to this horrible podcast.
All right. My pick is a Christmas movie, fittingly. It is a 1945's Christmas in Connecticut, starring Barbara Stanwyck and Dennis Morgan.
I've never even heard of this, actually.
No? No? What the hell is this?
It's good, is what it is. Here's a synopsis. Journalist Elizabeth Lane, played by Barbara Stanwyck, is one of the country's most famous food writers. In her column, she describes herself as a hardworking farm woman, taking care of her children and being an excellent cook. But this is all lies. In reality, she is an unmarried New Yorker who can't even boil an egg. The recipes come from her good friend Felix, an owner in a restaurant. The owner of the magazine she works for has decided that a heroic sailor will spend his Christmas on her farm. Miss Lane knows that her career is over if the truth comes out, but what can she do? And basically what happens is she has to agree to marry this man who has been pining for her because he owns a farm and he will help her out. He will take part in this ruse to have her host Christmas dinner for this sailor who thinks that she's a farm owner. And if she doesn't do this, she will lose her job as the food writer for this magazine. It's really funny. For 1945, the humor is pretty modern feeling.
Is it as funny as Funny Farm?
No, that's an abysmal movie starring Chevy Chase.
I just want to point out, I actually had heard of this movie because in 1990, I just looked it up to confirm, in 1992, there was a remake of this made for TNT, for TV.
Wonderful.
Directed by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well.
His only directorial effort is the remake of Christmas in Connecticut.
He does have a distinct visual.
When I think Christmas movies, I think Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, of course, Jingle All the Way. when I think biceps, I think arms were too.
Yeah, well.
Not so much Christmas. So, yeah, Barbara Stanwyck is fantastic as the woman who is posing as a food writer. She's also beautiful. I was just shocked how gorgeous she looked, even with the style of 1945. But, yeah, it's such a fun Christmas movie. And it's one of those incidental Christmas movies. It just happens to take place at Christmas. Yeah. There's no gift giving or anything like that.
Right.
It's really just this romantic comedy.
There's none of that Jesus bullshit.
None of it.
Thank God.
We wouldn't have it. So yeah, Christmas in Connecticut.
Nice.
Hallelujah! Holy shit!
All right.
You ready to go, Chris?
Flawless, yes. I thought I had recommended this before, but I did a search on cutprintfilm.com search bar, and I didn't. But if I had, I'm sorry. I'm going to repeat it again. So this is also a Christmas movie, and it's also a Shane Black film that he wrote, and it is The Long Kiss Goodnight, which is similar to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in title.
Oh, do tell.
All right. So like most Shane Black films.
Is there any kissing in this movie?
There is, and it's long, and it happens at night. So... like most Shane Black films, it takes place during Christmas time. So it's sort of like The Bourne Identity. So Gina Davis, she plays a housewife who basically they found her in a field a long time ago with amnesia. And now she's a housewife. She has a daughter.
It's a regular overboard.
Yes. So she has this happy life. But then she starts remembering these flashes of like violence from her past. And she starts being able to do these crazy, like... One night she's cutting dinner and she's able to like throw the knife like an expert knife thrower and all this stuff.
Fucking rules.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. So basically she finds out she used to be a trained assassin and like the people who were trying to kill her thought she was dead, but they see her on the news basically in this small Capra-esque town she lives in the Christmas parade. And so they come out of the woodwork to kill her. And so basically she hires a private detective played by Samuel L. Jackson back when he was like really cool, not just a parody of himself, but like acting Samuel L. Jackson. And so they team up and they just basically, the whole movie is just them trying to outrun these assassins. And it's a ridiculous movie. It's so over the top, but it's so much fun. Gina Davis is really good in it. Gina Davis, we talked about her in The Fly and how she was great in that too. And she's sort of like an actress people have forgotten about, but She's really good at playing like an ass kicker in this, which you wouldn't think from her. But she's tough and she shoots a bunch of people, and it's funny.
I always like tough Geena Davis.
Yeah,
like A League of Her Own. She's tough as nails in that movie. She's
I like Jeannie Davis when she grants all those wishes.
That's a terrible joke.
I don't like that joke.
And this movie contains one of my favorite lines in film history. I had mentioned it in one of our Cutprint film lists, where Geena Davis, when she kills the bad guy, she shoots him to death, and then she yells, "Die screaming, motherfucker," which is my favorite line in film history.
It's a good one.
Oh, it's so good.
I like that.
So my pick is 1996, The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Hallelujah! Holy shit!
And that clip, it's gold. Sorry.
It really is.
My pick is 2014's Happy Christmas.
Oh.
I was going to pick this today.
I've yet to watch it.
I'm glad you didn't. It is on Netflix, so you can watch it. Directed by Joe Swanberg, one of the forefathers of the mumblecore movement.
Yeah, he's a mumblecore darling, I believe.
I am not a fan of Joe Swanberg generally, but no, this is a very good movie.
I agree. Same here. And I was expecting to hate it because nothing against Joe Swanberg. That's just, it kind of grinds on me, those movies where everyone's just like acting awkward.
We're just hanging out. And
I liked Drinking Buddies. That was him, right? I thought that was him.
That is him.
I enjoyed that.
I've yet to see that.
I didn't enjoy that as much as this one.
Right.
This one's
I love the title of it, though. It's great.
Everybody's just drinking.
And their buddies.
Happy Christmas is good mainly because the characters feel so authentic. Like, that's something I love. Like, the dialogue's very authentic. There's no over quirkiness. Like, it never feels writer's roomy.
A lot of his movies are like improv, right?
Yeah.
Just like the actors just do with a thing. Like, yeah.
And that's what I hate about like these hipster comedies, is that everything's like writer's roomy, almost like Sorkin hipster, but right, this isn't that.
Yeah. This is very, very naturalistic. There's a lot of like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anna Kendrick says like about 1,400 times in the film, and it that alone just comes off as, oh, this is just natural.
Yeah, and her character is kind of hateable, but it works. And like, there's just like a cool warmth to the film. Like, it's very family oriented, and like, without being like too Christmassy, it feels like Christmas.
Thank God they released this movie in June, I believe.
Yeah,
makes sense. Makes sense.
It's a cool movie. The synopsis is just this girl Jenny, played by Anna Kendrick, moves in with her brother and his wife, and they have like a 2-year-old son, and she's, as like her rent, she's supposed to take care of the son,
right,
sometimes, but it becomes immediately apparent that she's completely irresponsible.
Doesn't she have like a drinking problem?
She certainly does.
Yes. And she burns a pizza in the middle of the night. It's like
and this pizza creates more smoke than I've ever seen in my entire life.
And it's just like stuff like that that's not that big of a deal. But if someone was living in your house doing it, it would be the worst thing ever. And there's a cool meditation, like how this difficulty actually makes everyone in the family grow a little bit. And like,
I liked it.
Yeah, it's cool.
And I love Anna Kendrick. And she's one of those actresses just like naturally charming, I feel like.
Yeah. And that's why this role is strange, because she's kind of she's playing like
a jerk.
But is still likable in the role somehow.
Because she's playing a real person. It's not a character that's like so over the top hateable.
It's not like the stepdad in Boyhood.
Nope, absolutely
the
not.
The number one film of the year, everyone.
Nope, she plays an actual person.
I hear Boyhood is the best film ever fucking made.
No, you're wrong. She she plays a character with dimension to her, and she's almost as some though she's someone in your own family that has problems, but
a real human, you mean?
Yes.
Oh,
if you will.
Oh, I miss those characters in the film Boyhood.
But what about the boy in his hood?
Oh, yeah, I guess he was fun, I guess.
2014's Happy Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to say Melanie Lynskey plays...
she's great in this.
She's Joe Swanberg's wife in this film.
And she has an Australian accent.
She's great.
She's from Australia.
She's a great actress. She's in a movie I recommended a while ago called Heavenly Creatures, and she's excellent in that, too.
Okay. All right, yeah, that's about it, right?
That's all we got today.
That's all she wrote.
Oh, isn't this nice? Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, I hope everyone out there in Cutprint Filmland does have a Merry Christmas.
I do too.
Hang a shining star upon.
Or a Happy Hanukkah.
Yes.
The highest. podcast.
The highest podcast?
Yeah, that sounded like we smoke weed.
I believe that would be the Smodcast.
Oh, boy.
What should we talk about? If you're out there and you're looking for something to read, why don't you go to cutprintfilm.com? Yeah.
We will have articles next week, unlike every other.
Yeah, we're not shutting down. Yeah, we have plenty of stuff.
We're not taking off because what the hell else are we going to do? So
yeah, exactly. Go to cutprintfilm.com. You can find us on Twitter at cutprintfilm.
Right. Tweet us.
Facebook.com/cutprintfilm. Won't you be our friend? I sure hope so.
Right. And then you should also look up Joystick Jerks. What do?
They talk about video games.
And then there's also antifanboy.com. What do?
They talk about comic books.
And
what does Cutprint Film talk about?
Movies.
We talk about everything, baby, but mostly movies.
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess that's it. Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Let's open our gifts.
Okay.
I got you all a copy of Boyhood.